I feel entirely undeserving and incredibly grateful to receive this distinguished award. And I thank my BYU colleagues, administrators, and students for making my job the best job in the world. I'm also thankful to Melissa Hockley and her team, everyone who helped put this forum together, and to my former students who are here sitting in the front, who will be performing later this morning. I'm really grateful for the work they put in to get this production ready. Of course, I'm especially grateful to my wife, Elizabeth, for being a sounding board, critic, supporter, and true friend all these years. Sorry. I hope you'll forgive my blatant display of ignorance. But I'm going to begin today by discussing something I know very little about. Then I'll move on to a topic I'm relatively familiar with. And I'll conclude my part of the forum by showing how these experiences, ideas, and movements have influenced and continue to influence my own writing. I've learned most of what I know about art, and it's not very much, especially contemporary art, from the time I've spent with my wife, an accomplished artist herself with a BFA and MFA degrees, walking through museums in the United States and Europe. Over the years, she's been patient with my low-brow, traditional view of art, and she's helped me see and appreciate the beauty and complexity of most contemporary art. But I have to admit that despite her guidance, I still have a lot to learn. Here are three brief examples. In 2011, we spent a day in Liverpool, England, where we toured several museums. One piece I saw in the Tate Museum that day remains especially memorable. It was an untitled work by Dan Flavin, an artist who was, not surprisingly, unfamiliar to me. Elizabeth recognized it immediately, but I was baffled. How is this, a work of art? A few years later, as we strolled through the Art Institute of Chicago, we came upon this art installation. The free candy immediately appealed to me, despite my wife's artistic explanation, I couldn't accept a pile of candy as a work of art. And not long ago, we visited the Hirshhorn Museum in Washington, D.C., and entered a room there where a contraption in the ceiling dropped a piece of white paper every few seconds. This was, I knew, some kind of art. We were in an art museum, after all. But I didn't have the background knowledge to appreciate it for what it was. Clearly, to me anyway, art ain't what it used to be. When it comes to art, I acknowledge my ignorance, and I understand, sort of, why contemporary conceptual art often leaves me flat-footed. Most of it lacks the defining characteristics, the traditional traits I must have learned somewhere along the way of what makes art, art. But here's the thing. When I think about my various encounters with what I call non-traditional contemporary art, I have to admit that the three works I just shared with you have generated more thought, discussion, and interest than all the paintings and sculptures I speed-walked past in the world-famous Louvre Museum combined. My art appreciation quandary can be explained in a number of ways, including lots of ignorance, but I'd like to explore how my understanding of genre might influence my ability to broaden my understanding of contemporary visual and other forms of art. Genre for a particular thing can be explained as the commonly accepted essential characteristics of that thing. For example, if I ask you to imagine a pencil, you'll very likely envision an image that's similar to what I have in mind. A yellow wooden instrument about 7 inches long with a pink eraser on one end and a graphite tip on the other. Consider now this image. If I ask you what it is, you'll probably say a box of facial tissue. But how do you know it's a tissue box? What are its defining characteristics? Well, it has tissue, you say, and it's a box, and it has a brand or label on its side. But if I remove the last tissue, is it still a tissue box? Well, it may not hold a tissue, but it has the characteristics of a box of tissue. It has a label on the front, a slot for dispensing tissues. It's made out of thin cardboard, and so on. But what is it now? How do you know that? And what about now? And finally, what about now? Is this still a tissue box? At what point does it cease to be a tissue box? Like this box of facial tissues, most things have defining characteristics. Qualities that, especially in writing and literature, help us define or classify things according to a genre. We recognize most works by their defining, generally accepted traits. And while it's nice to know something about genre and what it defines, As a writer, I've learned that an understanding of genre can also help artists create or make or perform things. A painting, a poem, a polka, or a prelude, for example. Important as they are to understanding of what makes something something, these traits are not usually static. In large or small ways, they often change and evolve over time, and in some cases, like those three works of art I shared with you, they may have almost none of the defining qualities that would have been expected a century or even a decade earlier. Even something as traditional as a BYU devotional has changed over time. For decades, the speakers stood behind a pulpit and read from notes. Sometime later, they read from teleprompters. Around the turn of the 21st century, the format began to include visuals, usually photographs, but then even more elaborate graphics and even video. More recently, the speakers have moved off the rostrum to stand on a round stage with images projected directly behind them. We still recognize the gathering as a devotional, and we could quickly, if we wanted to, make a list of essential qualities that define this kind of BYU assembly despite the recent changes it's undergone. In the last couple of decades, my area of study, young adult literature, has undergone significant, interesting, and exciting genre changes. The traditional work of fiction, what we've always called novels, has been a centerpiece of young adult literature for more than a century. Novels have been clearly defined as extended prose narratives, works of fiction that told stories using setting, character, and dialogue to create a plot for readers to enjoy. Novels had a reliable set of rules, genre traits that readers, writers, and publishers accepted and expected. But as the 20th century drew to a close, the young adult novel began to change. I don't have time to go into a lot of detail here, but let me show you some examples to give you a quick rundown. Bull Run had not one or two narrators, but 16. Mouse, a long comic book memoir, was called a graphic novel. Make Lemonade was written in articulated lines, not prose paragraphs. And then Out of the Dust was composed as a long series of free verse poems. Whirligig blended time, setting, and character seemingly at random. Likewise, instead of a singular unified plot, Holes had three distinct strands, each from a different point in time. Monster blends genre, prose, screenplay, illustration, to tell a single story. And in the days before texting, TTYL was a novel composed entirely in chat room instant messages. The invention of Hugo Cabret was a hybrid novel, half traditional prose, half wordless illustration. And then The Arrival was a novel composed entirely with illustrations and no words. These are only the tip of the literary iceberg. Nowadays, it appears that traditional genre rules no longer apply, and trying to contain the creative evolution of young adult literature is like trying to draw boundaries on water. The traits are fluid and ever-evolving, and sometimes it seems that as soon as someone redefines what a young adult novel is or must be, some author takes that as a challenge to write a book that blurs or obliterates those boundaries. As a teacher and as a writer, I've followed this evolution of the novel form with great interest. And as a writer who's also a slacker, who most of the time has no idea of what he's doing, I'm always on the lookout for an approach or a method that makes my novel writing easier. And I have to admit that the student in me often wonders, exactly how long does a novel have to be? Or in other words, what's the shortest acceptable form this novel will be and still count? Let me illustrate how genre evolution has influenced my writing by telling you about my most recently published novel. And I've written several since this one, but they remain, probably with good reason, unpublished. I like writing historical fiction because it allows me to blend the creative pleasure of writing fiction with the intellectual pleasure of exploring history. A few years ago, I decided to write a novel set in the 1960s, a complex, turbulent decade in American history. And after researching the 60s, I settled on 1968, a year packed with civil unrest, political turmoil, and heartbreaking assassinations, all taking place while the steady static of the Vietnam War thrummed in the background. I learned that 68 was a turning point in the war for several reasons, not the least of which was a staggering death count. More American soldiers died in Vietnam that year than in all the previous years combined. in a manner similar to the daily COVID case counts we currently receive, in 1968, newspapers reported the war casualties every Thursday. That year, 16,592 U.S. soldiers died in Vietnam. When I'd finished my research, I started writing the story of a 17-year-old boy dealing with conflict at home, complicated by the specter of Vietnam. I wanted this young man, a kid who would soon be draft bait, to be forced to confront all kinds of crises and ultimately have to sacrifice for someone he loved more than he loved himself. With all this in my head, I pounded out a first chapter, then another chapter. But as the novel grew, so did my sense of despair. My story was boring. That's a terrifying revelation for a writer, and it's also a sign that a book has some undiagnosed fatal flaw. But knowing that first drafts are usually flush with fatal flaws, I pushed ahead. But as the pages piled up, so did the boredom, and I knew that if I couldn't fix whatever was wrong, I'd have to dump the entire project. I woke up early one morning stewing about this stupid book and what I could do to save it. One of the few things I liked about it was the odd appearance of the number 17. My main character was a 17-year-old born on May 17th. His father had played college football and had worn the number 17. I liked how that prime number had worked its way into my story, and I wondered, could 17 somehow be the key to fixing my novel? But how? Well, maybe I could divide the book into 17 sections. Or maybe the story could be told from 17 different perspectives. What else? Well, haiku. They have 17 syllables, 5 in the first, 7 in the second, 5 in the third. Could I use that? Maybe a haiku epigraph could head each chapter. Or maybe the main character could write haiku messages to his girlfriend. Or maybe this was going nowhere. Thinking about numbers is never a way to solve a novel problem. But then in my desperation, I wondered, was 1968 divisible by 17? Turns out it wasn't. But even if it had been, what could I have done with that? What else? The death count, 16,592, was that divisible by 17? Turns out it was. 16,592 divided by 17 is 976. Nice coincidence, but how does that help me revive a dying manuscript? After a bit more stewing, I decided to start over and to write a novel contained by a syllable count of 16,592, one syllable for every American soldier who died in 1968. I had zero confidence that it would work. With fewer than 17,000 syllables to work with, I'd have to leave out so much novelish detail that my book might fail simply because its many gaps would make it impossible to feel or read like a novel. But let me read you the first page so you can see what I came up with. There's something tidy in 17 syllables, a haiku neatness that leaves craters of meaning between the lines but still communicates what matters most. I don't have the time or the space to write more, so I'll write what needs to be remembered and leave it to you to fill in the gaps if you feel like it. In 1968, 16,592 American soldiers died in Vietnam. And I'm dedicating one syllable to each soul as I record my own losses suffered in 1968, a year like no other. The challenge of writing and revising an entire novel in 976 haiku stanzas breathed life into my dead manuscript, and eventually it turned out that at least one publisher considered it a novel. So how did all the strange modern art, the thinking about what makes a tissue box, and those unusual young adult novels, how did they influence me? Well, if I hadn't already been familiar with all the genre-bending, boundary-blurring artistic work that came before, I could not have possibly conceived of something like this weird little haiku novel. My current book project is a cousin to that novel. After learning so much about the Vietnam War era, I wanted to write another novel that explores how the tragedy of a young man declared MIA, missing in action, affects not just his family, but his entire community. And I wanted to figure out a way to have the Vietnam draft lottery play a role in the story. I also wanted to write a novel in a non-traditional format. I wondered how many genre traits I could leave out of a novel and still have it be a novel. Could I write a story that approximated an impressionist painting? Could I use broad, vague brushstrokes that omit essential traditional elements of a novel? Could I trust my readers to fill in the gaps? Could I ignore chronology? Could I write a story where the main character, the young man who would eventually be declared missing in action, never appears, is never even named? While I was poking around for a method to this project's madness, I read a novel-y kind of book published in 1915, Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology. That book got me thinking that maybe I could write my novel in the form of free verse poems written, spoken by family members and friends left behind by this missing in action soldier. And because I was already appropriating one American classic, I decided I might as well make it two. So I used the title and character names from Shirley Jackson's 1948 short story, The Lottery, in my story. This project's far from complete. I'm sharing with you a really rough, bumpy draft. Currently, I have 115 poems from 30 different characters, and despite its current lack of polish, I do like how it's shaping up. I'll conclude my lecture by sharing with you a brief excerpt from this novel experiment, but rather than read it myself, which would be boring, I've enlisted the support of 9 wonderful and kind-hearted former students who will read the roles of 9 characters from Lottery. As you watch and listen, I invite you to think about genre and your expectations of what a novel must be and how boundaries can be bent. And most of all, I ask you to consider Don Flavin's Light Bulb in a Corner to see if it sheds any light on the potential of my work in progress to one day be some sort of novel. Thank you for being such a kind audience. Now, on to Lottery. December 4th wins first place in draft for 1972. Men born on December 4th, 1952 will be first in line next year for the draft. That was the luck of the draw yesterday as Selective Service pulled capsules from 2 plastic drums to determine the order in which men will be drafted in 1972.
This baby, tiny, red, and soft, snuggles like he's still a part of me. He looks so fragile, and I'm learning to hold him properly, but I'm terrified I might hurt him. And despite the painful delivery I just endured right now, I would suffer anything to keep him safe all his days.
We were born the same day, he and I'm older by a few hours. We joke that I'm his big brother, even though he's almost a foot taller than I am. He was the new kid, and we rode the same bus to McKemmy Junior High every morning. He was tall and skinny back then, and awkward. I'm Brad, I told him, when we shared the sidewalk waiting for the bus that hot August morning. He said he was from California. His dad worked in Phoenix. He had a younger brother and a sister. He'd never been in Arizona before. What he didn't say, but what I could tell, was this. He was scared to death.
That boy, he didn't tease me like the others did. He was kind to me. Sometimes they said he loved me and wanted me to be his girlfriend, but they were liars. Kind does not mean love, it means nice. And he was nice to me. Sometimes he shoved boys who were teasing me. He said, "Don't listen to them, Twyla, and don't cry, Twyla. It will be all right." I liked seeing him in high school, but now I don't know where he is. I really miss him.
Every time my brother touches the ball, the crowd's roar surges into a wave that crashes through the stadium. He breaks through tacklers like they're wooden puppets. Watching from the bleachers, I bask in his reflected glory, proud to be the freshman brother to the guy everyone knows, loves, and cheers for.
My heart pounded when I snuck into school in the early morning dark. I felt like a thief, petrified that someone would catch me in the act. But all was quiet in the dim light of the hallways. I didn't need much light to find my way to his locker. For months, I've watched him from a distance, cloaked in my shyness and overwhelmed with love for a boy who doesn't know I exist. Looking both ways, I quickly tape a birthday card to his locker and dart out of the building.
Mrs. Horner is talking about Spoon River Anthology again today, but this time she's brought in a record player, and we're listening to people reading poems. The voices are way too somber for me, so I start word doodling. Draft, a light breeze. Draft, a first attempt. Draft, a cup or a drink. Draft, a vacuum that sucks guys into war.
In English today, we read a short story that Miss Gorell says is a modern American classic. Everybody in the village, including a cranky old man, shows up for this annual ritual where each family has one person pull a piece of paper from a shabby black box. And the person who gets the black spot has to have everyone in his family draw, even the kids. A man ends up with the black spot, and his wife starts whining. It isn't fair, but the family has to draw, all five of them, and the mom gets the black spot. The story ends with her getting stoned while crying out, "It isn't fair, it isn't right." In this weird lottery, the winner was actually the loser.
After Pearl Harbor, we didn't think, we just enlisted, swept up in the call to serve our country. And before I knew it, I was on a Navy ship in the middle of the South Pacific. I saw tropical storms, burning ships, and POW camps in the Philippines. And none of it felt heroic. It felt tragic and painful. I decided, though, that whatever it cost, this war was worth it to guarantee that my sons would never have to do what I had to do.
Guess what? That cute boy from my sophomore English class, the one who used to torment me until I cried, I asked him to the Sadie Hawkins dance, and he said yes. I feel like I won the lottery.
I always knew my oldest boy was an athlete. He never tired of playing, throwing, or running, and when he was playing, he never felt fear or pain. I can't tell you how many scraped knees and bloody noses he came home with over the years, always oblivious to how he'd been injured. I'll never forget the first time I watched him carried off a football field. Freshman year, some dirty brute rammed him helmet to helmet. I lost my breath as if I'd been the one hit, and I saw my son motionless on the field. Coaches and trainers ran to his side, and someone signaled for a stretcher. By the time they loaded him onto it, he was moving, and somehow I was able to breathe again. And soon he was sitting up and talking to the trainer, and then standing up and telling the coach to let him back in the game. Thank God the coach sent him back to the bench, where he sat and pouted until the game was over. But the images of my poor boy flat on the field and being carried off on a stretcher, they haunt me still.
I used to hate him, you know. He teased and tormented me endlessly in our sophomore English class. Some days my tears spilled over before I could escape into the hallway. But a year later, he changed, grew into his body, I guess, but in the right way, less foolish, more kind. And I saw in him a sensitivity that had been hidden beneath his stupid sophomore veneer. He had always been easy to look at, but somehow he also became easy to love.
In English class, Myth Smith said that unrequited love makes powerful stories. Writers know that readers understand love and longing and the painful knowledge that despite your love, all your love, it will never be consummated. It's like being hungry all the time while being surrounded by, tempted by, lured by delicious food, knowing you'll never be able to take even one bite.
I forgot what day it was when he and I sat down to watch the 10 o'clock news. The news anchor talked while the screen showed some old men fiddling around with a couple big plastic drums, and a few stone-faced kids stood around. The camera panned the audience, and it was kids and old people, talking, some even laughing. He said it reminded him of a weird short story. "The first men born in 1952 to be drafted," said the anchorman, "will be those born on December 4th. And I said, "Hey, that's your birthday." At first, he didn't say anything. Then, staring at the TV, he whispered, "It isn't fair. It isn't right."
When he left, I wept. Not that he saw, I made sure of that, but watching him get on that bus tore my heart. Now I understand why my mother cried when I went away to war, and why my father seemed so distant. The young soldier that was me looked ahead with faith in the system, in the cause, and with a bit of patriotism. I'm proud my boy has that, but he's also got naivete. He'll find out too soon why they say war is hell. And I weep not just for his loss of innocence, but for the real risk of losing him for good.
"He's just like all the rest of us boot camp grunts. Shaved head, weary eyes, baggy fatigues. But the one thing weird about this guy is that every night he slides out of his bunk when he thinks everyone's asleep and kneels on the floor next to his bed, whispering who knows what to God.
I do not like Americans. They treat me like a slave just because I work in the chow hall and do laundry. They call me ugly names, and they leave a big mess. I cannot complain because my family needs the money. Most of the GIs think I am a slut, but I am not. And they think I do not understand English, but I do. And they think I am not human, but I am.
We agree that death feels like a roommate, and you know you talk about it and think about it way too much. It lingers like a sticky shadow stalking you around the clock, and you can't help wondering, will I know when it's coming? Will I hear the footsteps of death? Some guys believe in premonitions, that death tips his hand before you cash in. But I gotta tell you, we've got a permanent premonition. On patrol or on our bunks, we know we're just a bullet or a chunk of shrapnel away from the end. Maybe being a pessimist is a stupid kind of defense mechanism, but at least that way we won't be surprised.
The first time I saw that GI, he smiled at me. But not like other GIs smiled. They smiled at me like they were hungry and I was the meal. Sometimes when I cleaned up in the chow hall after he'd eaten, he would thank me. Once he gave me a flower. That made me turn red, especially when all the other soldiers whistled and yelled, but he made them shut up. One time he asked me about my family. I could not answer, only cry. He said sorry and wiped away his own tears.
Foxhole fever strikes when you're dug in, waiting for a firefight to start. The damp jungle heat makes you sweat. The machine gun fire and mortar shells make you shiver. The cure? Daylight and the all-clear signal.
The Secretary of the Army has asked us to express his deep regret that your son has been reported missing in action in Vietnam since the 12th of November, 1973. He was last seen while on a combat operation when a hostile force was encountered. That telegram was only the beginning of our grief. Days, weeks, months of waiting for news. Was my poor boy dead? Worry gnawed me like a cancer, and in time I realized his fate might be something worse than death. What's worse than death? Missing in action.
Missing in action. Missing in action, missing, in action, missing, in action, missing, in action, missing an act, ion missing an act, ion missing an act, ion missing an action, miss, ing in action, miss, ing in action, miss, ing in action, missing in, action missing in, action missing in, action missing an action, missing in action.
I never minded living in his shadow, but now, now that shadow is longer and darker.
If you had asked me who, of all the guys who went to Nam, was the most likely to return a war hero, I would have said him. And I would be half right. He 100% is a war hero, but he has not returned.
Sometimes I just stand in his room. His trophies and plaques and photos and posters fill the shelves and walls. His civilian clothes still hang in his closet. His stereo still has Creedence Clearwater Revival record on the turntable. Sometimes I enter his room in the morning, watching the sunlight filter through the curtains, and I'll sit on his bed and turn on his radio to listen to his favorite station, the same station he listened to every morning for years as he got ready for school. Sometimes I stand in his room awash with memories of my dear, sweet boy and cry and cry and cry for him.
Sometimes at night, I remember him from school days, and it makes me feel real sad. So I look at his picture in my yearbook sometimes, and I cry a little. I wish I knew where he went. I wish he would come back home.
I brought my children, grown now, to D.C. to see the sights. The city overflows with history, museums, and monuments, and we saw them all. On our last day on the Mall, we made our way to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall. Walking downhill, seeing the wall of names rise higher, I felt a growing sadness, a sense of loss long buried but hardly forgotten. One of my daughters noticed my pace had slowed. touched my elbow, and moved on, leaving me alone to search for his name. It had been more than 40 years, and my life had gone its own way. I'd had real joy and real sorrow in those decades, but I was not prepared for the emotion that swamped me when I saw his name and ran my fingers over the letters carved in black granite. All the grief flooded back, fresh and sudden, as I leaned against the wall, silently sobbing, over his loss and mine.
I welcome you to the question and answer part of today's forum with Dr. Chris Crowe. And we're so grateful to you, Dr. Crowe, for what you've shared with us today, for teaching us about art and genre and writing and the humanity of that we can learn from in the arts and in the writing that we read. We're grateful to you for creating literature for us. As part of the forum, the question and answer provides an opportunity for anyone in the audience to respond to your talk and pose questions directly to you. We ask you to state your name and, if you're a student, your major, and to limit yourself to one question. I'm assisted today by Dr. Christopher Oscarson, Associate Dean of Undergraduate Education and Director of General Education, who helps sponsor these forums. Dr. Crowe, we'd like to welcome you back to the stage. And I'm going to take a prerogative and ask you the first question. Tell us a little bit about your writing process. Do you have to have the right pencil? Is it at the right time? Do you have to have snacks? How do you begin sitting down to write? How do you know when you're ready to sit down to write? And then we'll turn the time over to Dr. Oscarson. Go ahead.
Snacks are great. And sometimes I use a snack as an incentive that if I don't write a certain number of pages, I can't have a snack until I get to the next section. But for me, the best thing has been over the years to make it a habit at same time, same place every day. So one of the great blessings of being at BYU is they have these little cubby holes in the library that have no Wi-Fi and no windows and no phone cell service and no distractions. And when I go there, there's nothing I can do except sleep or write. And usually I try to write while I'm there. But I think there's something that's conditioned me that in that spot, this is where I do this thing. And it cuts through some of the other avoidance tactics that come up with writing.
Hi, Dr. Crowe. My name is Elizabeth Wallace. I'm a comparative literature student. My question is about basically what draws you to the novel as a genre. I really liked your tissue box analogy about how kind of the genre is sort of a fluid thing and not always what people think of. But what is it that you find innately appealing about a novel for what you want to convey?
I wish I knew how to write a regular kind of novel, and I just haven't figured that out very well. I mean, I've written lots of them, but nobody can read most of them. And so I think the alternative formats are interesting to me simply because it's a new way to come at an old problem for me of writing a traditional prose narrative that goes for a long time. But I like novels more than stories simply because there's just more meat to it. There's more character development, more possibility for plot twists and other kinds of things. So that's been the attraction to me.
Thank you.
Thanks, Elizabeth.
If you have a question, we'd invite you to come to the microphone and ask a question, and you need not be a student to ask a question.
Hi, Dr. Crowe.
Hey, Jeremy.
As you know, my name is Jeremy Holbrook. I'm a communications advertising student here at BYU. In your address, you talked about Spoon River Anthology and The Lottery as some of your influences for your current writings. I was just curious, what other either works of literature or other works have had a major influence on you, and in what way?
It's hard when you've read lots of things to remember what exactly gave me this idea or made me think this way. I think for historical fiction, the first novel that really made me think about the possibility of, or to admire how someone could take fiction and history and make it one, was Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry, a novel published in the 70s. It's a really personal story, but it seamlessly integrates all the stuff of a good novel with these elements of history that make it a good novel. So that's one book I admire, even down to the sentence level. Her skill with writing, it just blows me away. And so when I read her work, I just think, well, I wish I could do that someday. So, but there are lots, I think some of these books I talked about today open doors of different possibilities. A novel doesn't have to be this one way. It could be another way, maybe.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy. Rebecca?
Hi, Dr. Crow. I'm Rebecca. I'm a master's student studying creative writing. I'm curious about your research process when it comes to form. I know you do a lot of research for the history element, but when it comes to haiku and Death Coming Up a Hill and these more free verse poems in Lottery, what's your process for researching poetry, I guess?
Well, Rebecca knows about this because she just did a historical novel for her MFA thesis. For me, the danger of writing historical fiction, you know this too, we've talked about it, is that it always gives you an excuse not to write. I need to learn one more thing, I need to read one more source, I need to track down this one more item. And it feels like it is work, but it's not the harder work for me, in the least of writing a novel. So I think for the research part, I try to get to a saturation point where I feel like I'm starting to see the same things over again. I sort of know everything I think I need to know for this novel. Then once I start writing the fiction, there's a point that usually comes where there's something I don't know. This scene's going to take place, but I don't know about these details, and so I better find out before I can go on. I really do need to do some research. It's not just a diversion, but it's necessary to figure out the next thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking.
Hi, I'm Madeline, a communications studies major. My question for you is, you mentioned that there were about 30 different voices in this work that we read from today, and there was only 9. What were some of the other voices that we didn't get to hear today?
So I was thinking, I really was thinking broadly, like if a kid from a relatively regular town disappears, who's affected besides his family? And people in the post office, doctors who knew him, who, you know, through as his childhood went through, was a regular doctor, coaches, other teachers, kids he didn't really know in high school but just sort of knew of him, rivals from other teams and sports, grandparents. And so in this larger draft, his grandfather fought in World War I, and so he had the same dream his son had, that I'm fighting this war so my boy won't have to. But it turns out in 3 generations, they're all unlucky enough to have to fight that final war. So as I was casting about, it was really a random process of just thinking who might know someone, who knows someone in a town, and trying to imagine that person and a voice and what their point of contact might have been, and then to wait for some sort of a poem. And these aren't really poems. They're written, they look like poems, but they're not really poems. But to write something, a vignette maybe, that would go with that character.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
My name is Hale Croft. I'm a pre-business student, and you mentioned during your lecture that you've written a lot since your last novel and that a lot of it is going to remain unpublished. And so what I want to know is, obviously the writing process includes a lot of revisions and kind of edits and changes after you've kind of written the bulk of the content. And what I'd like to know is, how do you know when it is time to publish something, when it's ready to release that piece of writing into the world, even though there might still be more things that you think need to be changed? How do you know when to let that go?
That's a really important question, and it's hard to know. And some writers, and I've done it myself, keep revising in ways that start hurting the project instead of making it better. It's that partly because of the fear of letting it go. I'm fortunate that my wife reads like crazy, and so when I think I'm done with something, I have her read it, and she'll usually tell me if it's ready or not for someone else, someone outside of my immediate community to see it. So publishers also have that same concern. They don't want to be seeing lots of garbage that hasn't been refined yet. So the idea is that there are gatekeepers along the way before it even gets to a publisher who help get it in shipshape. Before they consider it. And, of course, they're going to suggest, like you said, even more revisions, right? It seems it never ends. But it's a hard thing to know when it's done. Sometimes it's just fatigue and say, okay, I don't think I can do anything more with this, so send it off to get rejected.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hale.
I'm Debbie Dean.
Yeah.
And I work in the English department. And I was able to read an earlier draft of this, and there were several changes that you made since then, including taking the dates off of the individual poems. So what do you anticipate are the changes you're going to make from this point to the next draft in order to accommodate some of the things that you noticed from that revision to this one?
Well, that was great feedback with that earlier draft, but the dates were confusing. I mean, some dates were crucial, so that opening scene with the kid being born on December 4th, that's an important connection for the reader to make. And I was thinking there are other dates, like when the draft lottery is taking place and when this kid would have been in Vietnam, how many years had passed, those kinds of things. But I think when you guys read it and gave me some feedback, I realized it's not really necessary. It's self-explanatory, with the exception of a few cases. And, cutting this down to 15 minutes or so that we had for the forum made me really think about, okay, which are the moments that have some sense of unity and that show what I'm thinking of for the larger work, but also have some kind of continuity that feels sort of like a story. So I knew the end had to be Vietnam or the wall, but the beginning was kind of random of this kid starting off. So I think I'll continue just to write. Think of characters in a town, think of their connection, write that, and see what pile of things I've got and sort them out. Have you read it again and tell me how to fix it.
Okay, all right, thanks.
Thanks, Debbie.
I'm Jess Chrysler. I used to teach with Chris, but I retired. I want to shift gears a little, Chris, from the writing process to the educational process. You've shown us covers of a number of mixed genre, alternate genre works, many of which you've taught, some of which you introduced me to teach. How do students react to those? Many of these students come even today pretty schooled in what they think the genre of the novel is, and you've introduced them to many things that they would find unusual, I think.
That's why I like teaching English 420, our young adult literature class, because it's a chance. We read about 30 books in a semester, so it's a chance to say, here's what's out there. They go from these kinds of books you might be familiar with all the way to something like The Arrival, where there are not even any words, and to help them see that there are lots of possibilities for what can be called literature. I think for the English majors, what's initially jarring would be two forms. The graphic novel doesn't seem literary and doesn't quite seem like a novel. But nonfiction is something English majors rarely think of as literature. They think of it as documentation or something. And in young adult lit right now, there are lots of wonderful narrative nonfiction writers that surprise my students. And there are some who still, when they list all the books in order that they like, throw all the nonfiction at the bottom. But there are still some nonfiction books or graphic novels that float to the top of all the books they've read that really surprise them. And I think they like that surprise.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jess.
Hi, Chris. My name's Melissa Hockley, and as you know, that I did my doctorate in instructional psychology and technology and really focused on improving teaching. And I would love to hear, especially today as you have received this award of the Carl G. Mazur Excellence in Teaching and also in Research, the most distinguished award here on campus, what are the things that you do that I guess engage your students as you are teaching, and in what ways do they teach you?
So one of the things I learned, so one of the photos in there in the introduction, I think, was the Tintern Abbey with the London Study Abroad group from 2011. So Amy, wherever Amy went, oh, there she is, was one of the students there. And the experience of living, so we lived in the London Center, you travel together, you eat together, you have class together. That kind of relationship that was different than we have on campus. And there are opportunities just to have one-on-one discussions with students about what they're reading, what they're thinking, what they're writing, they were doing, what problems they might have encountered, and other kinds, their families, their homesick, or great stuff they found, or good chocolate somewhere in East London. But it reminded me that that's the most important, for me anyway, that's the thing about teaching that matters most, the relationship with students and helping them move to where they want to go, the next step. So I tried to formalize that here by forcing my students to talk to me one-on-one. They bring in a set of questions that for me to answer to them, but they have to give me some questions for me to ask them. And it just I like how it helps me see them as a single person, not some kid in the back of the class or in a crowded classroom, whatever it happens to be, but to really feel like them as like I see them as a person. And I think they see me differently too, I assume, as opposed to just the guy in the front of the class. I think I've learned over time in my years at BYU that our students are so smart and so diligent that we can really pile on and they'll do everything. They'll do all this, they'll dig through that pile. But what I've learned over the years, that a lot of that stuff that I was piling on them wasn't as important as I thought it might be. It was just, I knew they could do it. But it diminished their attention from other maybe more important assignments in the class. So I had to reevaluate, what do I really want them to do? And what's really most important for me and for them in terms of learning what this class should teach them? And so I started shedding a lot of these ancillary assignments so we could focus on the things that mattered most. And I really enjoy that. The other thing, too, for me, I was on a committee a few years ago on, I can't remember what it's called, spirituality in the classroom, some campus committee. And it made me think more about how important it is to pray before class myself, but also with my students, too, just to invite the Spirit to come and help make class more successful. So I still don't know. I feel like I still don't know what I'm doing, just like writing novels. I don't know what I'm doing as a teacher. I'm still figuring it out, and I'm grateful I'm allowed to continue to keep trying to figure it out. But it's complicated. It's an art, right? It's hard to quantify teaching.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
Hi. I'm Beth. I study piano performance.
Thank you.
I have a question. So when you write difficult material like this story about like grief and loss and war, like that's very emotional, very beautiful, but do you have to find a way to kind of separate that in your daily life since it's kind of heavy to think about, or do you let it affect your day? How do you deal with that?
I try not to let it affect my day, but obviously sometimes it does, especially in the research phase. So when I was learning about the Emmett Till case, this horrible civil rights tragedy, it was hard to shake that when I got home, to not think about it. I can't believe what I learned today or what I read today. Can you know what happened in the trial? So my wife had to hear all these stories of the stuff I was processing too, and so she was getting a layer of it as we went. With the Vietnam era, I think it's easier for me to compartmentalize some of that stuff and just say, okay, I'm working on this, but now I'm home. And a lot of it's not surprising. I think we know more about the 60s in Vietnam than we knew about Mississippi in the 1950s and all the Jim Crow, the small things about Jim Crow that were really insidious. So it probably depends on the project. If it's really close to home personally, it's a little bit harder. But in some ways it helps me because it's on my mind. So with fiction, there's a kind of momentum that's required to keep the story alive in my head. So if it's personal, then in the morning I might wake up thinking, I'm thinking about that character, I'm thinking about the scene. So with this project, Lottery, I often wake up thinking of, there's this other voice, this other character. I need to capture that one and add it to the pile of poems.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Amy.
I'm Amy Banks. I'm an adjunct professor here at BYU. And you've had a lot of success in publication in your writing, but what advice do you have in terms of rejection for writers as it is a part of the process for everyone?
So Death Came at the Hill was my fastest rejection. It was about 20 hours from the time my agent sent it to a publisher and it came back. It's like address was bad or something. It was a quick rejection. It's hard. We as writers, all of us, even when we write stuff for school and it doesn't get the grade we want, it's a kind of rejection. I think it's, for me, I get mad. I think the person who rejected it was stupid, just like I thought when I was a student. The professor just doesn't get it. That he should know, she should know better. But I realize it's part of the process. So a long time ago, I recognized that being rejected was a sign that I'm in the game. Because if you're not getting rejected or accepted, you're not in the game. You're just doing something else, but you're not really trying to get, you're not in the game of publishing. So I see it as validation that at least I'm a player, but now I need to become a better player to get motivated. So I try to, usually I put it away for a while and trying to think about it, and I'll revisit it with fresh eyes. And I often then will see why it got rejected. And sometimes it's just a matter of the venue wasn't the right place. So I sent something to someone who doesn't really do the kind of thing I've written. So I need to look more carefully at the journal or whatever, or the publisher, whoever, whatever I'm trying to work on, to make sure it matches what their mission statement is.
Thanks.
Thanks, Amy. Amy and I co-authored a book chapter just last spring.
Are there any more questions? I have a question again. So you brought the story of Emmett Till to many, many people, the tragic story. And today is 1 year anniversary of the death of George Floyd. What have been your thoughts about Emmett Till and about race relations in the past year? And do you have any reflections for us today?
Frankly, I'm sad that Emmett Till is still relevant, that his story is still relevant, because those kinds of things are still happening. Some parallels in the case are really clear to me, that how important the image was. So one of the things that launched the Emmett Till case into public view was the open casket, the viewing his mother had, and this horrible disfigured corpse that people saw and was sent through the press. And it woke people up, including African Americans, who some thought, our lives are pretty good, it must be getting better everywhere. So it was an awakening, and the video of George Floyd's death had a similar effect, where it's undeniable. You can't talk your way out of that. And because it's so undeniable, we have to confront it then and see what we can do better. To me, one of the big differences that shows we've made progress as a country, the Emmett Till case, the jury, the buddies of the killers, exonerated those guys, and a month or two later, they confessed in a national magazine that they killed them. In the George Floyd death, the justice system worked. There was a jury appointed, there was a trial held, and he was convicted. So that's a huge positive mark of progress that we've made as a nation.
Thank you. I think you're also a historian as well as a writer. We appreciate all of your questions today. We really appreciate you being willing to ask questions, and let's give Dr. Crow a round of applause. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.